Galatians chapter 3, verse 26, "For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Now, this evening, we're going to start on the subject of racism in the United States. So we've seen that the racism that led up to Nazi Germany, and the fact that this racism was clearly based in part upon evolutionary theory, specifically upon Darwinism. Now, the documentation for that is laid out very convincingly and effectively in the book entitled From Darwin to Hitler, Evolutionary Ethics, Eugenics, and Racism in Germany by Richard Wycott, published in 2004. I highly recommend that book if you're interested in that subject. We've also seen that the early 17th and 18th century in the early 17th and 18th century, there were attempts to classify the races of mankind on a scientific basis. Some of these pre-Darwinian efforts at classification were non-evolutionary. Some merely hinted at or toyed with the idea of evolution. And some clearly involved pre-Darwinian schemes of evolution. Now, from all of this, it's clear that alongside the development and extension of slavery in the United States, beginning in the late 1600s, there was an ever-increasing intellectual climate that isolated Africans into a distinctive biological group. As evolutionary views became more dominant, the basis was laid for more and more of a racist attitude toward Africans. Now, I have to make it clear that there was not a straight line correlation between racism and evolutionism. The situation is much more complicated than that. For instance, when we go back to the mid to late 17th century, these mid-1600s to the late 1600s, we find that already in Maryland and Virginia, intermarriage between Africans and whites was being prohibited by law. Now, I don't know about you, but when I look back at that, I thought, well, why is intermarriage between blacks and whites being prohibited by law so far before any evolutionary type or biological type racism came into view? So part of my study has been an effort to answer that question, and I think it's been very enlightening to me. First of all, we should remember that much of the legal, much earlier in English history, there had been a legal prohibition of intermarriage by one group of white people with another group of white people. It happened very early. It happened in the 1300s. And what is known as the Statutes of Kilkenny. The background to the Statutes of Kilkenny is stated in the text of the statutes, the reason that's given for their passage. And they were passed, by the way, in 1366. And here is that text. "Now many English of the said land," speaking of Ireland, "forsaking the English language, manners, mode of writing, laws, and usages, live and govern themselves according to the manners, fashion, and language of the Irish enemies, and also have made divers marriages and alliances between themselves and the Irish enemies aforesaid, whereby the said land and the liege people thereof, the English language, the allegiance due our Lord the King, and the English laws there are put in subjection and decayed. The prime author of the statutes was Lionel of Antwerp, better known as the Duke of Clarence and also as the Earl of Ulster. In 1361, he'd been sent as viceroy to Ireland by Edward III in order to recover his own lands in Ulster, if possible, and to turn back the advancing tide of the Irish. The statutes were enacted by a parliament that he summoned in 1366. The statutes began by recognizing that the English settlers had been influenced by Irish culture and customs. They forbade the intermarriage between the native Irish and the native English, the English fostering of Irish children, the English adoption of Irish children, and the use of Irish names and dress. So here is something that that we, looking back upon it, would not consider to be racist, certainly not in the biological or modern sense of racism, since it was between two groups of white people. That still does not really answer in full the basis for the prohibitions of intermarriage between blacks and whites in the late 1600s in Maryland and Virginia. And by the way, that was later replicated in New England colonies, such as Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, which also passed laws against intermarriage between whites and blacks. The evidence suggests that even at the early date of the late 1600s, something was going on in America that had racial overtones. But before discussing that, I have listed six factors that I think contributed to racism in America. And I'd like to list them for you. First of all, the physical difference between Africans and the dominant white race. To the white European settlers of America, this would be a glaring difference, and certainly to the Africans as well. The difference in skin color, the difference in other features that go along with the two races. Number two, the cultural difference between Africans and the dominant white race. After all, most of these Africans were coming to America from tribes in Africa where there was no written language, primitive conditions. This was not always the case. Some of the Africans that came to America, a few, were educated people before they came. this would be because they came basically from Muslim areas of Africa where they had been taught Arabic and could read and write the Arabic language. Third, the enslaved condition of Africans and the tensions that this caused between the races. Fourth, the influence of the great chain of being. Now, this is something that we have not discussed, and we will be discussing in more detail tonight. But it is a big factor, the great chain of being. If you've read much history, then you've encountered that term numerous times. Fifth, the fact that early 17th and 18th century science began to classify all races of humanity as a part of the animal kingdom. And sixth, the development of evolutionary theory in the late 18th and early to mid 19th century. Now, as I said, the factor that we have not discussed at all up to now is the great chain of being. The term, the great chain of being, is a rather late term that historians have used to describe something that was a reality almost throughout the whole of the Middle Ages and became more important as the Middle Ages advanced into the modern era. And in fact, in the late 1700s, there was a great emphasis made in America upon the great chain of being. We mustn't let that divert our attention from the fact that the concept of the great chain of being existed before the late 1700s. Now, what was the background to the great chain of being? Well, the basic idea that is a background to this concept, I guess I ought to give a brief definition of it before I give the background. The great chain of being is simply the view that everything in the universe exists in an orderly progression from God down through the angels, down through men, through the animals, through the plant life, to the stones and to the sand, and all the way down to the devils in hell. The background to it is the idea of an inexhaustible divine productivity which has to create all possible forms, thus establishing a full and continuous chain of existing things. Now, this concept was transmitted to Christian philosophy from Neoplatonism, and it came chiefly through the medium of Augustine and the Pseudo-Dionysius. It gave rise immediately to a series of paradoxes at the heart of Christian thought. The first and most important of these paradoxes was the question of reconciling this divine constitutional inability not to create every possible thing without exception with the divine attribute of liberty. Well, we could go on with that, but let's give a more detailed explanation of what the great chain of being was. Now, in order to do this, I'm going to quote from a book that I recently acquired. You could almost get any history book and get this. But this book is entitled Early Modern England, 1485 to 1714, A Narrative History, by Robert Buchholz and Newton Key, second edition, published in 2009. And at the outset of this book, the authors give a picture of the mental world of the English people in 1485. Now, 1485 was the transition point between the medieval period and the modern period. It is the date when Henry VII, by conquest, attained the throne of England, establishing the Tudor dynasty. These authors say that apart from God, who was thought to be indivisible, each of the ranks in the chain of being was further subdivided into smaller hierarchies. Medieval theologians did not just think of angels, for example, in an undifferentiated mass. Rather, they divided these celestial beings into nine ranks, from seraphim and cherubim down to mere angels. Animals, too, could be arranged into a hierarchy. Was not the lion the king of beasts? Was not the eagle a nobler bird than the sparrow? The whale a greater animal than the codfish? Plants, too, could be ranked. Compare the mighty oak with the lowly fern, as could stones, diamonds versus granite, for example. And so with man, kings, nobles, gentlemen, yeomen, husbandmen, cottagers, common laborers. The king was, of course, the ruler of the kingdom, the fount of justice and honor, God's lieutenant on earth, and the owner of 5% of England. His office in person will be addressed further in subsequent chapters. Just below him in the great chain of being, ready, theoretically anyway, to assist him in his rule were the 50 or 60 families who in 1485 made up the English nobility. That's probably surprising to you that there were only 50 or 60. This rank, like all links in the chain, may be further subdivided into dukes, marquises, earls, viscounts, barons. Each title had been granted by the king and was inheritable by the eldest son of its current holder when the latter died. Nobility entitled the holder to sit in the House of Lords. Noble titles were, moreover, generally accompanied by grants of high office and landed estates and virtual rule of their shires. As a result, these 50 to 60 families owned perhaps 5 to 10% of the land in England and commanded annual incomes ranging from £3,500 for the greatest landowners, the Dukes of York, down to as little as £60 per annum for the relatively poor Lords Clinton. How does that make you view inflation? Such great wealth, extensive land holdings, and military commitments implied large retinues of servants known as affinities, which might include estate managers, chaplains, servants, tenants, political allies, and hangers-on. Theoretically, every person in England could be placed exactly within the chain. For example, individual ducal families could be ranked by order of creation. That is, if one family had received its dukedom from the king before another family, it outranked that family and would line up nearer the sovereign in ceremonial processions, preceded by other, more recent ducal families, who followed families of marquises, who followed earls, who followed viscounts, etc., all in strict order of creation. And, of course, within every family, noble or common, there was a ranking. Father, mother, male children, eldest to youngest, female children, eldest to youngest. As this indicates, the chain implied a hierarchy of genders as well as of classes. An even more important feature of the chain was that the top rank in every subdivision was analogous to the top rank of every other subdivision and of the chain itself. That is, the father in the family, the king in the kingdom, and of course the professor in the classroom, were analogous to God in the universe. They represented him. They wielded his authority. They were the unquestioned heads of their respective links and spheres of activity within the chain. Clearly, English people in 1485 were obsessed with order. Their fondest desire was apparently to account for every speck of matter in the universe and place it in a hierarchy. Equally, their greatest fear was that order would break down. It should be understood that this was a chain, not a ladder. No one could move up or down, for that would imply imperfection in God's plan. Now, of course, that's the ideal. In point of fact, people did move up and down. But that was the ideal. A fern cannot become an oak. A codfish cannot become a whale. A mother cannot be a father. Nor should a husbandman try to become a peer. And of course, no one could aspire to be the king but the divinely appointed, anointed, and acknowledged heir of the previous king. To rise or fall in this society was to rebel against the chain, against order, and thus against God. Indeed, for any creature to attack its superiors in the chain, for example, for a son to strike a father, for a subject to compass rebellion against the king, was tantamount to Lucifer's infamous revolt against his creator. So that is a picture of the great chain of being. Now you can see how this type of thought would fit into a situation in which races are beginning to be classified as races. And immediately there is the question, which race is superior in its characteristics to another race? Now, of course, Linnaeus, as we talked about, you remember we talked about Linnaeus, the great originator of classification in biology, did separate out the races. He didn't really try to classify them in order of priority because he was probably did not even subscribe to the great chain of being personally himself. But he did give characteristics of the races, some of which were very prejudicial to black people and to red people, etc. And of course, the characteristics he assigned to Europeans were the best characteristics. So with that kind of situation existing, you can see how people would tend to start thinking about one race as superior to, in some way, other races. Now, when the great chain of being confronts modern science, it begins to break down. Because you have a basic question of classification. I mean, the great chain of being classifies by something that's very obvious. But when you start asking the question, you know, what are we actually going to use for classification, then it becomes more difficult to decide just what we ought to use. For instance, if man is a part of the animal kingdom, why are not elephants superior to man if you would judge by size? Some of the early classifiers toyed with the idea that elephants should be right under man on the basis of intelligence, because elephants were held to be the most intelligent animal, more intelligent than the apes. And there were a number of the classifiers who toyed with this idea. Most of them eventually rejected the idea in favor of apes because apes looked more like men. But the question is, what criteria are you going to use for classification? Well, the next book I want to go to for enlightenment is a very, very interesting book called White Over Black, American Attitudes Toward the Negro from 1550 to 1812. Notice that this book ends in 1812. Starts in 1550, ends in 1812. It's written by Winthrop D. Jordan, and I don't know anything about Winthrop D. Jordan, but I do know from reading his book that he was a very, very astute and interesting author, very careful scholar. Everything is documented, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, and he wrote with obvious good judgment, and oftentimes with a lot of wit. Going back to the situation that existed in the 1660s, Jordan says, in the early 1660s, when slavery was gaining statutory recognition, now that's an interesting thing. You have to remember that initially slavery started in this country without any laws to back it up. In fact, people didn't really know exactly how the Africans who were first brought to this country were going to be treated as far as their servitude is concerned. Europeans who were brought to this country as servants, indentured servants, were brought under a covenant or a contract, usually to serve for 7 years, sometimes as much as 15 years. So there was the question, I mean, how long are they to serve? Under what circumstances are they to serve? It was not until the early 1660s that slavery was beginning to gain statutory recognition. The assemblies of the colonies acted at this time with full-throated indignation against miscegenation, the intermarriage of the races. These acts aimed at more than merely avoiding confusion of status. In 1662, Virginia declared that, quote, if any Christian shall commit fornication with a Negro man or woman, he or she, so offending, should pay double the usual fine. 2 years later, Maryland banned interracial marriages altogether. And he quotes from the statute. When Virginia finally prohibited all interracial liaisons in 1691, the assembly vigorously denounced miscegenation and its fruits as, quote, that abominable mixture and spurious issue, end of quote. Now here's Jordan's assessment of what was going on. From the surviving evidence, it appears that outright enslavement and these other forms of debasement appeared at about the same time in Maryland and Virginia. Indications of perpetual service, the very nub of slavery, coincided with indications that English settlers discriminated against Negro women, withheld alms from Negroes. There were statutes before the miscegenation statutes that deprived Negroes of the privilege of bearing arms. And through the timing, and though the timing is far less certain, reacted unfavorably to interracial sexual union. The coincidence suggests a mutual relationship between slavery and unfavorable assessment of Negroes. Rather than slavery causing prejudice, or vice versa, they seem rather to have generated each other. Both were, after all, twin aspects of a general debasement of the Negro. Slavery and prejudice may have been equally cause and effect, continuously reacting upon each other, dynamically joining hands to hustle the Negro down the road to complete degradation. Much more than with the other English colonies, where the enslavement of Negroes was to some extent a borrowed practice, the available evidence for Maryland and Virginia points to less borrowing and to this kind of process. A mutually interactive growth of slavery, an unfavorable assessment with no cause for either, which did not cause the other as well. Is slavery caused prejudice? He's talking about racial prejudice. If slavery caused prejudice, then invidious distinctions concerning working in the fields, bearing arms, and sexual union should have appeared after slavery's firm establishment. If prejudice caused slavery, then one would expect to find these lesser discriminations preceding the greater discrimination of outright enslavement. Taken as a whole, the evidence reveals a process of debasement of which hereditary lifetime service was an important but not the only part. Certainly it was the case in Maryland and Virginia that the legal enactment of Negro slavery followed social practice rather than vice versa. As early as 1669, the Virginia Assembly unabashedly enacted a brutal law which showed where the logic of perpetual servitude was inevitably tending. Unruly servants could be chastened by sentences to additional terms, but where, and he's talking about indentured servants, unruly indentured servants, but, quote, whereas the only law in force for the punishment of refractory servants resisting their master, mistress, or overseer cannot be inflicted upon Negroes, nor the obstinacy of many of them by other than violent means suppressed. And what he's saying is, if you had a white indentured servant, and that servant was rebellious, you could punish him by extending the length of time in which he would have to serve, tacking more years onto his servitude. But that option was not open with Negroes, because they already were being bound for life. So, if a slave, by the extremity of the correction, should chance to die, his master was not to be adjudged guilty of felony, since it cannot be presumed that prepensed malice, or malice with forethought, which alone makes murder felony, should induce any man to destroy his own estate. In other words, if physical chastisement, beating of the slave, causes his death, it's not to be punished as a felony, because it's presupposed that he wouldn't want the slave to die because that deprives him of his property. Virginia planters felt they acted out of mounting necessity. There were disturbances among slaves in several areas in the early 1670s. By about 1700, the slave ships began spilling forth their black cargoes in greater and greater numbers. By that time, racial slavery and the necessary police powers had been written into law. By that time, too, slavery had lost all resemblance to a perpetual and hereditary version of English servitude, though service for life still seemed to contemporaries its most essential feature. In the last quarter of the 17th century, the trend was to treat Negroes more like property and less like men, to send them to the fields at younger ages, to deny them automatic existence as inherent members of the community, to tighten the bonds on their personal and civil freedom, and correspondingly to loosen the traditional restraints on the master's freedom to deal with his human property as he saw fit. In 1705, Virginia gathered up the random statutes of a whole generation and baled them into a slave code, which would not have been out of place in the 19th century. So, very early, 150 years before the Civil War, Virginia passes a slave code. Now, notice that he's talking about Virginia and Maryland. Virginia, by the way, was the leading slave state. It was the state from which most of the lower South got its slaves. Most of the slaves, the majority of them, came from Virginia rather than coming directly from Africa. Oh, huge slave population in Virginia. It was there that the slave population first became self-sustaining. Now, it's important to make that distinction because we also need to ask what was going on in New England, up in the northern states, where slavery also existed. And in connection with that, we're going to inquire as to what was the attitude of the church? What was the attitude of Christians while all this was going on? And it's very, very interesting because there was a distinctive attitude, a distinction between the attitudes in Virginia and Maryland and the attitudes in New England. And there's a reason for that distinction. And the reason has to do with the nature of Protestant Christianity in New England and the nature of Protestant Christianity in Virginia. In Virginia, the Anglican Church was the dominant church. In New England, it was Puritanism. So there's a little foretaste of what the difference was. But it's not what you're probably thinking. The Anglican Church was just as opposed to slavery, just as opposed to cruelty, as the Puritans were. But there's a reason why the Anglicans were not able to control it as the Puritans were able to control it. So we'll leave that for next time.